all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
Welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone. I'm the officer of the deck today. We've got some great programs for you. I think you'll find very interesting. We always want to remind you, you can find more about Veterans Radio at its Facebook site or by going to veteransradio.net, where we're on the web 24/7. You can find a lot of our podcasts there as well. We post new ones every Tuesday, so you can get a new story, a new interview, something you didn't know before by going to veteransradio.net. And before we get started, we want to thank our sponsors. First up, we want to thank National Veteran Business Development Council, NVBDC.org. It was established to certify both service-disabled and veteran-owned businesses. You'll find out how they can help your business by going to NVBDC.org. We also want to thank Eisenhower Center. It's a brain injury recovery center. Learn more about EisenhowerCenter.com. They're located in Michigan and in Florida. We want to thank Legal Help for Veterans. Legal Help for Veterans fights for veterans' disability rights all across the nation. You can reach them at 800-693-4800 or on the web at legalhelpforveterans.com. Contact us if you'd like to be a sponsor on Veterans Radio, and let's move on to our program. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today Lieutenant Colonel John Locke, retired U.S. Army, and we're going to talk about the most recent Medal of Honor recipient, Colonel Ralph Puckett, who was 94 years old when he received the Medal of Honor. He was given it to him by President Biden in May of 2021. Colonel, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Well, Jim, thank you very much. I appreciate you having me on.
Well, let me just set this up so that our listeners understand you're kind of the real deal, and then we'll get to the story. But as I mentioned, you retired from active duty as a lieutenant colonel. You served for 28 years from 1974 to 2002. You went to the West Point. Got your BS in electrical engineering and computer science, and you picked up a master's degree in operational research and statistics from Rensselaer Polytech Institute. So, you know, you're kind of a smart guy here, but you were in the Army.
I fool a lot of people.
Yeah. And some people might say, wait a minute, how can you say that he was in the Army? And you've got, you know, a long listing of very interesting assignments, including with the 1st Armored Division, the 82nd Airborne Division. And I'd go into this more, but this, as you told me as we set this up, this isn't about me. It's about Colonel Puckett. And I agree. Post-retirement, you've served as an advisor to the U.S. Army for warfighter exercises. You're an author. You've published a number of books. They've been endorsed by a number of impressive folks like Colin Powell and Bob Dole and historian Stephen Ambrose. And we'll talk about a little bit about being an author later in the segment here. But I wanted to set this up so that people can maybe understand, as you relate the events of Colonel Ralph Puckett in the Korean War that led to his receiving the Medal of Honor some 70 years after that happened, that you speak with a certain knowledge. So, John, tell us about the events that led up to Ralph Puckett receiving the Medal of Honor.
Well, as you noted, it was a little bit of a journey, an odyssey to say the least, about 18 years in the making. Upon reflection, we were driving down to the Medal of Honor ceremony the other week. I was going over it with my wife, and it dawned on me. I was trying to figure out exactly what the impetus was that set this all off. I obviously had written a book on Ranger history, and I'd literally, embarrassingly, stumbled across the Battle of Hill 205 and then Lieutenant Puckett. And I consider myself a relatively knowledgeable military historian in a number of things, but I was not aware of this. And also as a fellow graduate in West Point, it was kind of embarrassing. So I decided I wanted to look into it some more. And in the process of writing the book, I reached out to Colonel Puckett at that time. This is in the early 90s. And he was very generous in the sense of providing me materials that I could use to write the chapter associated with the Korean Rangers, 8th Army Ranger Company. And so that had placed in the back of my mind the fact that there's more to this story here. This is not the downplay by any stretch of the imagination. It's a Distinguished Service Cross, the second highest award, of which he has two of them. For years, I just kept thinking that there's more to this. I had an opportunity to speak with, at that time, it was Colonel Stan McChrystal, who's the regimental commander of 75th Regiment. And Colonel Puckett was the first initial honorary colonel. And that's another interesting side story, because that's a position that was set up by the Chief of Staff, U.S. Army. It was a 2-year assignment. And every new regimental commander would bring on board his own, quote unquote, honorary colonel. And after 6 regimental commanders in 12 years, Colonel Puckett finally had to tell the 7th regimental commander coming in, you need to give this job to somebody else, let them experience it. So that just goes to show you, you know, the reputation that this man had. But I had that opportunity to talk with Colonel McChrystal. He agreed that it was Medal of Honor worthy in his own mind. So that was there in the back. And finally, around 2003, had an opportunity to put together a packet and this is when going down with my wife, I figured out how this came about. Because I was putting together a packet for a distinguished graduate for Association of Graduates at West Point. And putting that together, you put together a narrative, and you obviously you write out you flesh out a theme in terms of what makes this individual worthy to be a distinguished graduate of the United States Military Academy. And after I had finished that out, and he ended up, quite obviously and rightfully so, he was nominated and accepted as a distinguished graduate in 2004. But at that time, I realized, why not take this the next step? I had just retired a couple years prior and was in the process of doing other writing and research and such. And finally, I just said to myself, I've already taken it this far. Let's take this baby around the road, around the neighborhood a couple times for a spin. Let's see what we can do with it. And so that really was the impetus. That's what started the journey and the quest to secure for him an upgrade for the Medal of Honor.
Well, tell us about what the Battle of Hill 205 was about in Korea back in November of 1950.
Well, the interesting thing with the battle, and this is what I was looking to get conveyed in the comments from President Biden, was that the battle really started before Hill 205. Here we have a brand new second lieutenant. You know, anyone who served, and certainly anybody who's been in a leadership position as a junior officer, as a junior NCO, can appreciate what it is trying to motivate and bring a unit together. And in this instance, you have a brand new second lieutenant out of West Point. All he has is a little bit of infantry schooling from Benning. And he goes over, he volunteers for, and next thing he knows, he's assigned as the company commander to raise this novel 8th Army Ranger Company, first Ranger unit to be brought to active duty post World War II. And he has 2 classmates or his platoon leaders, and he's only allowed to bring on board non-combat, non-infantry type of individuals. And so he's soliciting and interviewing all sorts of, you know, clerks, cooks, drivers, mechanics. I mean, everybody who's not skilled at all in carrying a rifle. And then he has to take and put together. He not only personally handpicks and selects each and every individual. And by his own admission, later on, he indicated, I had every type of Dash American that there was, every type of ethnicity. He also brought on board 2 African Americans, who, again, which is really rather novel, given the fact that Truman had only desegregated the military a year or two prior to that. So, again, he was just looking for 2 things from these people. Are you passionate, motivated enough to learn what needs to be learned, and were you willing to follow me? And so that was primarily his criteria. And then he led by example. He put together a training regimen that he initially had been told he had 7 weeks to execute, but he ended up with only about 5.5 weeks. So again, he's taken from scratch these individuals and training them, forging them into a relatively elite, certainly for that time frame, light infantry unit. And so now you move that forward to Thanksgiving weekend of 1950. And he's assigned, the Ranger Company is assigned to an armored task force. And so the day before they actually had a fight, they took another hill 224. And in the process of doing that, they endured not only some casualties to enemy fire, but they also endured fratricide. American tanks, the tanks they were riding into battle on, ended up firing on them and killed 3 Rangers. So they get on top of the hilltop. They dig in at night. It's about 0 degrees. They have no food, no hot, no cold weather gear. And so now you're asked the very next morning, the 25th of November, to go ahead and attack Hill 205. And so you're already relatively fried. You've already attacked one hill the day before. You've suffered KIAs, killed in action in the process. You spent a miserable night. You've had individuals who hypothermia and frostbite. They actually lost a couple of Rangers, so had to go back because of frostbite and hypothermia. Total sleep deprivation. Now they're asked to take Hill 205. And so the whole process there was riding into battle, taking the base of the hill. And during that time, Colonel Puckett exposed himself on 3 different occasions running across the field so they could identify and locate where an enemy machine gun was that was stopping the advance. And so they were to eliminate the machine gun. So he placed himself at risk there, his life at risk doing that 3 different times. They take the hill. And finally, later on that night is when the battle occurs, starting around 10 o'clock, about 2200 hours. Again, same thing. They're digging into frozen ground. And now it's actually even colder because you now have a chill factor from a pretty stiff wind coming in. So it's probably around minus 20 minimum. And now you're enduring an attack from a force that outnumbers you about 10 to 1. And so for the first 5 assaults, they were able to repel. The colonel was able to call in continuous artillery support. And he actually was wounded in the thigh with a grenade fragment in the left thigh in the first wave of attack and refused to be extracted off the hill. Later on, he was wounded again in the left shoulder. During another attack, so he has a second set of wounds, and he's still moving around. He's calling in danger close fire. Another episode, there was a Chinese sniper, enemy sniper, approximately 20 or so meters away, and taking pot shots at his guy. So he called out, "Okay, I'm going to do my bit here," and he runs once. The sniper shoots at him, and they shoot at the sniper and miss. He runs the second time. Same thing happens, and he says, as he relates the story, he says, "Okay, I called out to my guys the third time. You better get him this time because I'm not running anymore."
This is part of the story that I think, again, it's sort of hard to put yourself back 70 years where the technology was different, no technology, that the equipment was different. In Korea in particular, the lack of cold weather gear, these guys literally froze to death in some instances. And he's running across the rice paddies, the frozen rice paddies, and I think I read somewhere it's like 800 yards, zigging and zagging, trying to draw fire so that his guys nowhere to return fire. I mean, it's hard to think that a man would put himself in that position, but it was the only way to advance his troops and advance their safety. It's an incredible part of the story.
Well, it is. And in reality, when I went back to look at the DSC, the Distinguished Service Cross Citation, there were a couple of incidents like that were missing from it. And again, those are the kind of events that highlight the risk of life that should be emphasized. And so that actually was one of a number of things I ended up putting in there to, bring it up to, if we want to say, bring it up to a Medal of Honor, or at least have it identified as a Medal of Honor event. And so, but yeah, you need his picture again. You know, he does this again for the sniper later on, and he's running with a wounded leg. he's already taken some shrapnel in the thigh, so he's not exactly at full speed when he's doing this. And at the same time, he's redistributing ammunition. And this is the other highlight that is really stunning. You think about it. As I said, they're outnumbered by about 500-600 man battalion against their 50-some Rangers. And he's given away his ammo. He gave away all of his ammo except for one 8-round clip, to ensure that his Rangers could continue to fight. And so finally, on the sixth and final assault, which was around 2:20, 2:30 in the morning, that stage of the game, about 4.5 hours into the battle, the other thing to keep in mind here is that while this event is ongoing on Hill 205, the entire Eighth Army is getting its butt waxed, just soundly beaten across the entire front, because that's when the Chinese, Communist Chinese, came over. Even though it had been known that they were in the area, they kind of acted as though it was a surprise, had not anticipated or planned for it as well as they should have upon reflection. And so you end up with about 500, 600,000 Chinese now hitting the Eighth Army. And so you have units all along the front being overrun. And so the artillery that had been supporting the Rangers was shifted elsewhere. And so by the time that final assault came, there was no artillery fire to be able to call in. And that was when Lieutenant Puckett was in his foxhole attempting to call in. He was begging essentially artillery, we're being overrun, we need the fires. And that's when two mortar rounds came in and they detonated right behind him. And peppered his entire body, primarily on the left side and the soles of his feet, with shrapnel. And his right foot was damaged so badly that he actually had to spend about the next 6 or 8 months convincing the surgeons not to amputate it. It was that badly damaged.
And let's remind people here, and we're talking to Colonel John Locke about the exploits of Colonel then Lieutenant Ralph Puckett in Korea in 1950. But let's remind people here, John, there's no air support. If there's no artillery, there's no support. It's just you and on one side of the hill and the Chinese on the other, right? There's no air support here.
Yeah, I mean, that was it. It was nothing but their carbine rifles, the few had pistols, if you had a BAR, a couple machine guns, and hand grenades, and obviously the bayonet, because it did come down to the bayonet and hand-to-hand close quarters combat for a number of the Rangers when they finally got overrun.
How many men were with him as the battle to capture Hill 205 started?
The number is put at around 51 that went up, 51 plus. There are also a handful of Republic of Korean, South Korean soldiers that were with him, too. There were a lot of the units had a few augmentees from South Korea. And so there were a handful of also some South Korean soldiers that took the hill with him. By the time they got done and came down the hill, there were only about, I think the number was somewhere around 22 that were able to fall into ranks the next morning. So about 22 out of the 51 Rangers that went up that hill. And out of those, there are about 10 or 11, I believe, that were killed in action. A number of them were just end up being missing, MIA. Their bodies were never recovered.
And as the odds of the Chinese become overwhelming, there's a decision that has to be made to evacuate the area. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Well, there was at that stage, obviously, everything, as you'd indicated, there's no support, there's no close air support. Now there's no artillery support. So everybody's on their own. They're already a lot of the guys had already run low or if not out of ammunition. And so you end up with, again, a lot of close quarters combat going on. A lot of reports of a number of individuals took a last stand and were facing the enemy literally with a bayonet in their hands. And so at that stage, Colonel Puckett had Lieutenant Puckett had just been able to get himself out of the foxhole just barely. He'd indicated he tried to stand up and run, and he dropped to his knees after the first step or two, totally exhausted, and the injuries prevented him from even moving. And so he had indicated that, you know, he's just watching Chinese soldiers about to 10, within 10 meters or so of him, 10 yards, killing and bayoneting his Rangers, and he couldn't do anything about it. And it just so happened that a Ranger, one of his PFC Rangers, came by him. He had lost his weapon in the battle, so he wasn't armed at the time. And Colonel Puckett, Lieutenant Puckett said, you know, leave me behind. And that was PFC Judy. And he went down the hill, but he didn't just leave him behind. He ran. He encountered two other PFC Rangers, PFC Walls and Pollock, and indicated to him that the commander was back up the hill. And, you know, he needed help. And so those two charged back up. They were armed, still had some bullets. And so they literally charged back up the hill, knowing what they were facing, and came upon the lieutenant there. They killed three Chinese soldiers in the area. And then one of them picked him up, and while the other provided covering fire as they tried to move him down the hill. And they could only carry him for probably 400 meters. They had to get back down that hill because it's a slope. It's not, you know, 205 indicates it's 205 meters high, but you're going on the angle, the hypotenuse, you know, hypotenuse of the right triangle there. So you're covering a lot more distance than the 205 meters. And so, and you're also being shot at.
And you're almost out of ammunition, and there's no support.
You are. Yeah. And apparently, when they did come up to get him, that was the second time that he said, you know, save yourselves, leave me behind. But they refused. They picked him up. They took him down. They got to a small ravine, and they took inventory there, and they literally were no longer had any ammunition left. And they had one grenade. And they apparently all three of them kind of made a pact that we're not going to be captured. This grenade will come in handy to take care of us. So at that stage, Lieutenant Puckett, for a third time, told his men to leave him behind. And they refused to do that. So he said, okay, fine, put me on my back and just drag me down the hill by my arms. And that's what they did. They drug him down, and you know, he was suffering such pain. The joke was that, you know, he kept muttering to himself, I'm a ranger, trying to keep from yelling out in the pain. And finally, the Chinese could hear him in the distance. And so they're shooting in the dark. And apparently some rounds actually grazed, the individuals and put holes in their field jackets. And finally, both the PFC Rangers just turned around and said, sir, shut the hell up. You're going to get us killed. You know?
Yeah, you're not helping here.
Yeah, really. You're not helping the cause here. So they were able to get him down to the hill. He was still conscious. And even there, what they did is the tanks were at the bottom of the hill. They couldn't provide supporting fires because couldn't angle their guns up high enough. They apparently placed him on the back deck of one of them. But he called out and had artillery called Willie Pete, white phosphorus, a heavy barrage when the artillery finally was able to re-engage the hilltop, and had Willie Pete White Phosphorus fired in heavy concentration on top, which quite obviously would have killed dozens more of the enemy up there. So even in the end, you know, he still was doing his job as a commander to ensure that the enemy paid a heavy price for what they had just done to him and his Rangers.
So let me also give some background color to this. Ralph Puckett served for 22 years, so well beyond Korea. He actually saw combat in Vietnam when he retired in 1971. He had two Distinguished Service Crosses. Colonel Locke, John, explain to our audience what Distinguished Service Cross is all about.
Well, the Distinguished Service Cross, again, is the second highest, and a lot of people also have heard of the Silver Star, which is the third highest award for valor. So you have the Medal of Honor, Distinguished Service Cross, also referred to as the DSC, and the Silver Star. And Colonel Puckett now has the Medal of Honor, has one DSC, and then he has two Silver Stars also from Vietnam. And essentially, the DSC is quite obviously is a tier below the Medal of Honor, and primarily it's what it's looking at is the criteria is not as heavily weighted towards the risk of life that a Medal of Honor is. I mean, obviously, it requires a great deal of courage also. But generally, the DSC is more inclined to be awarded to those who haven't necessarily risk their life intentionally to the degree, you know, aside of what combat is, is in its own, you know, in its own right, a risk.
And this is all
does
this
not
is,
intentionally go out and, you know, put himself and expose himself to enemy fire.
Yeah, these are valor really kind of what. Yeah, these are valor awards well beyond just doing your job.
Oh, by far.
You know, so yes. So I wanted to get that across to folks who may not understand or appreciate how significant the Distinguished Service Cross is, for which Ralph Puckett received based on his activities on Hill 205. So let's wrap this portion up by also noting that Puckett maintained a heavy presence with the Ranger community, and some folks referred to him as the grandfather of the Rangers. Talk to us a little bit about, if you will, that commitment to the Rangers that he had even after he got out of his military career.
Well, as I indicated earlier, he essentially created his own training regimen, and it was focused on attention to details, small unit skills, individual skills, and physical training and discipline, obviously. He also rotated through positions in terms of everybody got to know and do everybody else's job. And he also, you go back, you take a look, he was an early proponent of after action reviews, AARs, and lessons learned, which I became very familiar with when I came into the service, ended up getting commissioned. NTC was really where that stuff started, restarted back in the mid 80s. And that was a regeneration of the U.S. Army's capabilities back then. So he literally established and created and established the Ranger standard. And he had the opportunity to be assigned when he came back to the States and is recovering from his wounds to the infantile, you know, the infancy, of the U.S. Army Ranger School. The course was just being started then, and he was one of the initial cadre. And so the standards that the school espouses today are primarily those very same standards that Colonel Puckett had created back with the 8th Army Ranger Company to train them. So the Ranger standards start there. We move on to Vietnam, and he volunteered to go to Vietnam. He did not have to go. He volunteered to go there as a battalion commander. That was apparently a spirited conversation with his wife, Jeannie, who's an amazing woman in and of her own right. But she agreed. And so he went there, and literally his moniker apparently was assigned, but everybody, all the commanders were given a name. And so the assistant division commander called him the Ranger, and it stuck. And ever since, he's always been referred to as the Ranger. And you have to understand, anyone who's in the Ranger community or Ranger qualified, you have to appreciate the fact that we're all type A, anal type of individuals for the most part. And for any one of us to acknowledge that somebody else is a better Ranger than we are. But with Colonel Puckett, we all are second tier, and we all understand that and very much acknowledge it. But to get back to what he did for the community, discussed about his being the initial. He was an inaugural inductee for the Ranger Hall of Fame when that was started. And he was, as I said, indicated earlier with the story that he was the initial honorary colonel for the 75th Ranger Regiment for the first 6th regimental commanders. But what was really unique about that, and this came up in a conversation a couple weeks ago, Colonel retired Rob Chopa, he's the president of the National Infantry Association, and he was of great assistance throughout this Medal of Honor ceremony, and he still is, in terms of now helping the Puckett handle the fame that has come with this, the rightfully so. But during one of the conversations that we had, he went down the list, he was thinking, of all of the senior general officers who have come through not just the Ranger Regiment, but also Fort Benning in the sense of being a Fort Benning commander. And he literally came up with a list that was close to 20 names. And we're talking 4-star generals. We're not talking the run of the mill 3 or 2 or 1-star. We're talking about 4-star generals, about approximately nearly 24 that Colonel Puckett has had an influence with, that he's been a mentor to, that he's helped counsel. And they've acknowledged the fact that he was instrumental in helping them with a lot of things, you know, understanding and seeing things, keeping things in the proper perspective, maintaining standards. And consequently, you can actually make the case that not just was he a Medal of Honor recipient here, and that's really the low end of the totem pole. In all honesty, in terms of what he's done, he has been an amazing influence on not just the Ranger community and at every rank. I'm talking about the common soldier, the common private that's out there. This man was in his 80s. And it'd be 2 o'clock in the morning, and a Ranger would be out there looking through his night vision devices, and wait, who's that? And he'd walk up, Colonel Puckett, what are you doing out here?
Well, it really shows you the impact one man with dedication and passion can give to his community. And we're talking about Colonel Ralph Puckett, recipient of the Medal of Honor. And what I want to do now, John, we're talking to Lieutenant Colonel John Locke, retired. I want to turn to the Medal of Honor ceremony that you had the opportunity to attend for Colonel Puckett, because I don't think many folks ever kind of get to have that experience, and maybe what leads up to it a little bit, and sort of, I can't even imagine what that day is like, that you're not, you know, bursting out with pride for your friend and colleague here. So tell us a little bit about that whole White House ceremony that maybe the general public doesn't see.
I mean, there are obviously, quite obviously, there's a lot of background motion in terms of coordination. And it makes it even more difficult when it's under the time of COVID. Quite obviously, you know, this is the first Medal of Honor ceremony for President Biden to do as president. And we're under, some aspects of COVID restrictions. And what that did is that restricted some of the numbers that we could bring in there. But we went without the masks, but we were tested prior to. I went a year and a half without. I had COVID way back February before last. I've had my shots. I went all this time without having my nose done, and I had to get the swab for this. But it was well worth it. But there's a tremendous amount, as you can appreciate, you know, the White House and Department. It's actually led by the service, whichever service the recipient is. In this case, it was Department of Army. And so the DA led a vast majority of the coordination efforts. They're really the escorts for everything until they get to the White House. And then in the White House, they take over. But the Department of Defense primarily takes the lead on all this type of stuff. And the DA, Department of Army G1, led by Lieutenant General Gary Brito, they were stellar. They were just exceptionally supportive of everything that we needed, everything that I needed to get done in terms of laying things out, getting orders, his uniform squared away. Literally his uniform spans 3 wars. He was a cadet at the end of the Second World War. So he was World War II. He has a victory medal in there. He's Korea and he's Vietnam. So he spanned, he spanned 3 wars. And so, we're able to put all that together. And this man was so humble, he would not even wear the Special Forces tab because it came into existence after he retired. And when I asked him about that, I said, okay, we're going to get this fixed. So we immediately got the orders cut for him. So you'll see now he's wearing the green. And you sit here and you think, in the Army, you want a CIB, Combat Infantry Badge, you want a Ranger tab, you want a Special Forces tab. I mean, if you can have those things, and here this man, he did not wear his Combat Infantry Badge after Korea for a while because he didn't have orders for it. He didn't wear the Special Forces tab because he didn't have orders for it. It's just amazing how humble and sincere this guy is. But the ceremony itself is exceptionally unique. Obviously, the recipient. And in this case here, his wife are taken care of and managed by Department of Defense. They handled everything, though in this instance, there also was a friend, an associate who provided them private transportation coming up to D.C., which was very nice. Didn't have to fly commercial air for that. And so came in, they put you up in a hotel, and the vision, you know, the Sheraton overlooking the Pentagon area and overlooking DC, it's right next to Arlington. Just an amazing view in terms of sitting there and looking out. And so, you know, we arrived in on, that was on Wednesday. And then Thursday, you had an opportunity to visit with the Pentagon and meet Secretary of the Army, Chief of Staff of the Army, and have lunch and such with them while everyone else, the family and close friends, had an opportunity to tour the Pentagon and certain aspects of it. Came back, had a media day event for an hour or so set up, had an opportunity for him to make remarks there and answer some questions. And then the next day, you know, you start off, you go to the White House, and again, how they treat a recipient or the family associated with them, you get literally, it's as though you're treating you as if you're the president of the United States in terms of putting you in a convoy, police escorts. You don't stop. You go through all the lights. I mean, it's a nice experience to observe and to be part of from the inside. You got to the White House, and the recipients go in through the front, so to say, and we end up going in. We did our swab testing and verification of all that stuff, and then we went into the East Wing, and you know, had an opportunity there to visit a number of the rooms. Now, anyone who does have an opportunity to go to the White House, I've had a few of the other type of tours. Obviously, this tour is significantly different in the sense of how deep you get into the White House on this one, and the opportunity just really kind of roam around. And the White House is an exceptional, it is a national treasure. It is a museum. Every room is a museum piece. That's the other neat thing. Every president has an opportunity to reach out to the Smithsonian Institute and take whatever he wants, he or she wants.
Well, borrow, not take.
Well, true. Correct. I stand corrected. I did not use precise terms precisely. Yes, they have an opportunity to borrow whatever it is that they wish to borrow and put them down there. So you're looking at swords and from George Washington and China from Lincoln and, you know, everyone else. And so time for the ceremony. Go upstairs and you walk into the lobby area, and you really have to, you know, certainly encourage anybody to take a look at the layout of the White House before, if you have an opportunity to go, so you know where you're at in relation to everything. And when you picture a president walking in and making a speech or an event ongoing in the East Room, you can put it into perspective, having seen some of this stuff earlier. You know, the stairs that the president walks down from the residence up in the second
floor. I'm going to take it, John, and I would expect nothing less, but the ceremony and the handling of this, even the media handling of this, is as dignified as it should be for somebody who's being recognized for the Medal of Honor.
I'll tell you, as I said, the White House itself is just an amazing, it's an institution, obviously, but it's just an amazing museum, even though it's a workspace. And the people there, I mean, again, you know, West Point graduate, went back, taught at West Point as a professor, assistant professor. So I've been around discipline. I've been around, you know, people who know how to handle uniforms, who maintain nice grooming, you know. But the individuals I saw there, the lieutenants, the captains, the majors, and the equivalent in the naval service and the Coast Guard that were there, were just stunning in terms of how meticulous they were. I mean, I just, even now, I go back and I look at the pictures and I just think, God, you know, that's one of the sharpest majors I've ever seen in my life.
You know, you
the
thought
assistant
that,
who was working, I'm thinking, man, you are, yeah.
I was
you
never
are
that
poster child.
Yeah, you were never squared that squared away is what
I
you were thinking.
I can sit here and say I thought I was relatively decent in terms of that stuff, but I sit here, you know, I had an opportunity to speak with the major afterwards, who was the primary escort for him, and another lieutenant. You know, they're out of the old guard routine, and I literally my jaw was half to the ground in terms of how impressed I was with them. So the White House is well represented by the U.S. military in there, and as you've indicated, it is an exceptionally dignified. It's dignified, but it's still not. It's not a stuffy formality to it. I mean, what was really neat was that I had an opportunity. My wife and I had excellent some of the best seats in the House. We had better seats than the Secretary of Defense, Vice Chief, Secretary of Army, and everybody else. I appreciated that. And actually, you had a U.S. senator sending to our left, you know, farther away from the stage. So we were doing pretty well in terms of where we were sitting, and had an opportunity to observe and see everything up close. But to watch the president, how he interacted with Colonel Puckett and with the family, you've got to get beyond the politics, whether you agree or disagree. The individual is just he is as humble and as nice as he comes across. Okay, it's not an act because what he did there with the colonel on the stage and on a couple different occasions to ensure he was taken care of, and getting the family up there to take a family portrait, and I mean literally he's orchestrating it himself. President of the United States up there, hey, come on up here, hey, you with the gray hair, come on out here, stand over here.
Why I wanted to talk to you about this, because we don't normally get the cameras, the news only gives you a 30-second clip, and it's the same clip every time, right? So I appreciate you giving us a bird's eye view of kind of what really goes on, and I want to switch to one more thing. I know I've overextended my time with you, but you have been so generous. One of the things, and we talked about this before, I'm going to call you a Medal of Honor Sherpa. Most people don't realize you referenced it in passing about the packet, but most people don't understand the process and why in the hell would it take 18 years to get this done. So being one of the few Sherpas out there that I can talk to about this, tell me about what it is to guide a packet for a Medal of Honor review and upgrade of the Distinguished Service Cross from your experience.
Well, I mean, to a degree, I hear the analogy there is, I think, very appropriate. Colonel Puckett is Edmund Hillary, the first to climb Everett, because with this Medal of Honor, Colonel Puckett now becomes the most decorated soldier in U.S. Army history, which is quite appropriate. And I'd like to think that I am his Norgay, just in the sense of being able to guide him through this process. As I've always said, they wrote the battle in blood, and all I did was put a narrative to it.
And let's explain to folks, John Locke, the Medal of Honor recipient never self-promotes this. That's not what this is about. These are humble men.
Oh, not at all. Exactly. And certainly in this case here, I know a couple other Medal of Honor recipients, and there is a weight. There is a duty and an obligation that comes with this award, and they recognize that. And that's one of the reasons why we're able to get Colonel Puckett to actually participate. He never brought this up. Okay, I took it to him, and on three separate occasions when we were dead, literally we were dead in the water over those 18 years, with no place to maneuver or any place else to go at that moment. He literally told me on each and every one of those occasions more than once, John, please stop. You're wasting your time. And what I was able to do, Jeannie, his wife, and I, we're co-conspirators in this. This is one of the few orders I refused to accept from the colonel. And what we recognized would get his attention was not the fact that this was a medal to honor him. It was a medal to honor his 8th Army Ranger Company, his fellow Rangers. And so that's how I don't want to say spun it, because that has a negative connotation, but it is one of the rationales, one of the reasons why I feel great about the fact that we were able to make this happen, is because it was not just for the recognition for Colonel Puckett. Because just like one of his, another Ranger who's known him for years, just like we have, the unique thing with what he did on that hill that hill in 205, he said that was just Ralph being Ralph. And that's exactly right. There was nothing, a lot of times a Medal of Honor recipient rises to the occasion. And again, nothing to take away from them, those who've done that. But with Colonel Puckett, as demonstrated later, you know, volunteering to go into West, going to Vietnam and earning another DSC for putting his command. I mean, he was a battalion commander. He put himself down.
Hang on, I'm going to bring you back though, because what I'm trying to understand is, you don't just put the package together and mail it to the Department of Army or the U.S. President.
I went off on a tangent there. My apologies. To have to start this whole thing off. Is that there has to be a whole, there is obviously a checklist process to go through. One of the things that has to occur is that you need to have congressional support. And so you need to reach out and get either a member, some member of Congress, either House of Representatives, a representative or a senator. In this case, here I was able to get a senator from Georgia to sponsor. And so you do put together, there's a whole packet of things that has to go together. And along with that, there's other individuals who've earned, who are Medal of Honor recipients, but never received the award because there were no witnesses.
Right.
And, in this case here, you have to have at least two witnesses. So I was able to, at that time, back in 2004, when I'm putting the packet together, 2003, 2004, there were still a handful of survivors. And so I was able to reach out to them and get witness statements from them. So I put together an entire witness matrix of who saw what, I picked out what events I felt were Medal of Honor worthy that needed to be highlighted, need to have witness statements for, and I was able to reach out and get statements for those things and put all that together. And then you just start the process. You send it in for the upgrade. That got denied. You send it in for an appeal. That got denied. And that was one – we're down at that point. That was dead in the water. Later on, I found out I was able to, the department or Congress had required Secretary of Defense to do an announcement, get back to him within about 6 months after the 2010 NDAA, National Defense Authorization Act, and explain to Congress why all recipients of the Medal of Honor post 9/11 were posthumous. They're all dead. And so the Secretary of Defense came back with the study and indicated did not come right out and say that. Things had changed in terms of the requirements subjectively, but it appeared that the requirement had become more of an individual had to have lost their life rather than risked their life, which is the actual requirement. So once I came across that, I went back and did the statistical analysis back in 1950, and I realized that out of 26 Medal of Honors by the 8th Army around that time frame, 22 were posthumous, two of them were POWs, only two were two individuals who were actually alive, available to receive them. So we had that statistical aberration there, and again, that was part of my advanced degree is statistics. I know that a little bit. And then our upgrade request and our the appeal were submitted post 9/11 and before 2010. And so we hit the perfect storm. Both of these time frames was when Colonel Puckett for consideration for the Medal of Honor, evaluators were looking at it from the perspective of one had to have lost their life rather than risked their life. So I put together that packet, sent it forward, and got shot down again. They didn't even read it because their indication
was, come on.
Well, they didn't even read it because we already had our two bites of the apple. The requirement is you get an upgrade, a review, and then you have a right to appeal that once, and that's it. I was going for a second appeal, which is not authorized by law or regulations. But that said, there have been exceptions in the past, and I found an exception or two where that did occur. And so we're dead in the water a second time, I feel I'm just saddened that it took me so long to really come up with the epiphany. I literally woke up one night at about 2 o'clock in the morning in 2018. And the image I had in my mind was John McCain walking out on the Senate floor and putting his thumb down, voting to sustain Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. And so I literally woke up and said to myself, there's a man who can help us. And so I reached out to him. And now, again, keep in mind, he's in the later stages, his advanced cancer. But he or his staff, wrote back, said, I certainly will reach out on your behalf. I send him a packet, and he sent it to the board, and the board wrote back the same thing, saying, I'm sorry, Colonel Puckett's already had his two bites of the apple. I'm paraphrasing it. But what happened was the fact, so that was our third dead in the water. But what happened was there was one sentence in there from the board that I had never seen before. And it said, if Colonel Puckett wishes to appeal this, he can go to the Army Corrections Board. Corrections Board? We were going to the Awards and Decorations Board, which is the requirement. You know, what are we correcting? We're not correcting anything. But I wasn't going to argue with it. And so I put the – so there was our end. That was the hook. It was a different board that would actually look at what I wrote in terms of the statistical aberration and you know, the fact that all these events were worthy of a Medal of Honor. Now, the other thing that I did to ensure that it got looked at was that, you know, sending it in from lieutenant colonel doesn't carry much weight whatsoever. And so I reached out to two other four stars. Okay, General McChrystal was just retired at that time, so he was one. And General Joe Votel, who was the current CENTCOM commander at the time. And so both of them were more than willing to write a one-page endorsement in terms of Colonel Puckett, he's earned and deserves this Medal of Honor consideration. But the real key was that now I had two four-stars who were interested. And one was active duty warfighter commander. So the interesting thing, though, was, again, this is the frustration. I sent it in, and I always send stuff in with a return receipt and the whole routine. So I know they received it. I waited a couple months, no response. I reached out to them, and they didn't have a record of it.
Oh, great, great.
So I said, okay, fine. So I sent them in, you know, sent a brand new packet in, and this time I reached out to General Votel. I said, hey, sir, I need you to have your staff call these people to make sure they got it. You know, let them know that there's a four-star now monitoring this. And again, you know, the key there is that you want to make sure that you're not providing undue influence in the sense of what decision is going to be made. But you do want to make sure that at least it's going through the process and being given due consideration. So long story short, the correction board said, yes, yay, verily, put the thumbs up. And so the beauty of the correction board is that they are the equivalent of the U.S. Supreme Court. And the Awards and Decorations Board is the equivalent of a state Supreme Court. So the correction board was able to turn around to the other board, subordinates, and say, relook this thing. And they did. They passed it, and they said, yes, everything makes sense now, now that we've read what Locke wrote in his memorandum. And it got forwarded. You know, the Secretary of the Army does his thing. It goes up to Secretary of Defense. Now we have another stoppage, though, because you a Medal of Honor by law cannot be awarded. It has to be awarded within 5 years of the event.
Right, which is a crazy part of the rule.
Then you need a waiver. Actually, has to become law. And so I did a snail mail, you know, insurgency campaign mailing out to a number of members of Congress, identify those who had prior service and obviously those who were representatives from Georgia. And then next thing I knew, pleasant surprise, it was in the Colonel Puckett's name was one of four listed who were provided waivers in the 2021 National Defense Authorization Act. And so then it just became a function of the getting a phone call from the president and then having the ceremony itself, you know, the date established. And you cannot, I mean, the timing is when you have the president of South Korea, you know, again, what was when, you know, you brought up what was it like in the ceremony. The other unique thing about that ceremony, if you go back and you take a look at it, is the fact that you have two presidents in there, which has never happened before. And one of those presidents is from the very nation that this man earned, you know, the Medal of Honor in. And in the President Moon's, you know, comments, he thoroughly recognized the fact that I would not be here today if it were not for men like Colonel Puckett, his 8th Army Ranger Company, and all the others.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yep. Absolutely. That's what made South Korea democratic society. You know, John, I really appreciate the extra time you've given us because we can't get a look at the inside the ceremony, and we can't maybe appreciate the Medal of Honor Sherpa duties that are required over 18 years and the number of stoppages and the whole award and deck no twice and then the corrections fix. I mean, I've never heard that before. So again, these are pathways that aren't written down, and you just sort of have to keep fighting your way forward, and that's probably a good thing for a Army Ranger colonel, isn't it?
Well, people ask why I pursued it for so long, and there's really two, you know, there's two reasons, and the first, quite obviously, is the fact that I wanted to right a wrong. Colonel Puckett had earned, Lieutenant Puckett and his Rangers had earned this distinction, and they needed to be recognized for it. You know, again, as indicated in the president's comments, you know, the forgotten war. And so I did not want them to be forgotten. And so that was the first piece. And the other piece is, quite simply, I don't like being told no by the Department of Defense or the White House when I know I'm right. That's all. It really is that simple. Yeah, unfortunately, it took me 18 years.
I can hear your wife in the background saying, I totally agree. That's his problem. He won't take no for an answer.
Oh, it is. I mean, and I'll tell you, and the other thing that I have to mention in terms of the White House ceremony, anybody has the opportunity, you know, I had to do a course correction in the middle of it, because generally, again, you know, you're around the president, the vice president, the secretary of defense, you got all these people there. And a lot of times I'm certainly not one who's going to inject myself in on these people. But what's unique about these circumstances and these events is they're busy doing other things usually. So if you want to meet them, you make the effort. And so I literally did that. I mean, that's, you know, that was the lesson I took away from this thing. These kind of events, I literally walked up, you know, after the president had put the medal on, and they're out there in the center of the room. And I just literally walked up, you know, congratulated the colonel for the medal, and the president was standing right there. And I reached over and shook his hand. And I said, you know, Mr. President, let me introduce myself. My name is John Locke. And Rob Chopa and I had worn, we had our color and the tab and all that kind of stuff on the uniform lapel, or not uniform, but our suit lapel. And he looked over at us and he sees the Ranger tab. And first thing the president said, doesn't even say hello. You know, the first thing he says is, oh, another crazy Ranger.
Well, good judge of character. Let me bring this
to it. That was pretty funny.
Yeah. Let me bring this to a conclusion here. Sure. John's given us a tremendous amount of information and time, but if you want to see some of his books that he's written on the Army Rangers, go to johndlocke.com/books. And that's Locke with an E on it. So John D. Locke.
No, Lock.
Oh, actually, I'm sorry.
I like being confused with a great English philosopher.
There you go.
But we apparently got rid of the E somewhere along the line.
Okay, well,
it's Locke.
some of the newspaper articles got you the wrong way too, then.
Well, they do. But what's nice about the article is that usually they have me down as a full colonel, so I'll take it. Okay.
Trade off.
They promote me one rank. They misspell my name, so I figure that's a wash.
Now I know why I had such a hard time finding you originally. My first email to John was like, do I have the right John Locke? Well, I appreciate all the extra time. And, you know, it's a great honor to Ralph Puckett and his Army Rangers. There's so many lessons to be learned from his life. I thank you for the insight into the ceremony and how you Sherpa this through in this situation. John, thanks a lot for your time today.
Well, Jim, I appreciate your time and the opportunity to spread his story, because it is a tremendous story that goes well beyond just the Battle of Hill 205 and well beyond. The Medal of Honor, in the end, for those who know Colonel Puckett, make no difference. It really, all it does is validate what we knew about the man. So I trust your listeners will reach out and do some additional research on him.
And I want to thank everybody for listening to Veterans Radio today. I am Jim Fossone. It's been a pleasure to be your host. I'm a veterans disability lawyer at Legal Help for Veterans, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800 or legalhelpforveterans.com on the web. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook and listen to its podcasts and internet radio shows by going to veteransradio.net. And until next time, you are dismissed.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
We would again want to thank our national sponsors, the National Veterans Business Development Council, NVBDC.org, Eisenhower Center, VA Ann Arbor Health Care System, the Vietnam Veterans of America Charles S. Kettles Chapter, Ann Arbor, Michigan, VFW Graf O'Hara Post 423 in Ann Arbor, and the American Legion Presscorn Post 46, also in Ann Arbor. They keep us on the air, as does your support. Go to Facebook, go to veteransradio.net, and support our efforts. And until next time, you are dismissed.